Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. For our international listeners, the podcast will be held mostly in English. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality. Episode 44, recorded September 30, 2021. My guest today is Alain Servet, acclaimed collector of contemporary art. Welcome, Alain. Very nice to have you.
Thank you very much for having me on, Daniela.
Alain, you are known as outspoken, opinionated, and educated when it comes to collecting art and to navigating the art world. And my first question would be about you personally. How did you become the person and then the collector you are now? Where do your origins lie?
Do you have 1 hour or two? Or it's a very difficult question. So it needs me to do a lot of shortcuts because it's much more complex than it is. I would say that my background is purely scientific and human sciences, like sociology and so on, and mathematics, because I had an MBA. And I was trained and formed to do finance, which I always and still deeply love. Funnily enough, I consider that a lot of finance, it's about humanity.
Why is that?
Because if you want to be good at what you're doing, you need to understand humanity very well. Whether it's even a short-term trader, it's about the human psychology, why people are buying now, when will they stop, when it will be turning around. But also, if you want to do more long-term investment, it's important to understand where humanity is. You know, what about internet? The massive changes in our life, organic foods or food retailing close to home, because we used to go to the big supermarket. Now we go to the closer supermarket, and it's massive changes. Not to talk about electric cars and so on. Not to talk about the place of women and genders in society, the behavior towards women, and so on, and so on, and so on. So all of this is important as well, which means that, you know, I had that massive interest in humanity in general, and it's every form. It was very useful in my business life. But I realized that art was a place where it was expressing itself also and opening up other type of doors. Because let's say that maybe finance is about the mean or the average, which mean mostly the normal people. And art is about the not normal people, or the one that some people don't consider normal at some point in time.
I always thought that art would be something so intrinsic to humanity itself that, you know, that everybody actually could relate to art if he or she wanted to.
I don't believe so. My vision of art is over the years, and again, it's shortcuts. It took many years for me to get to that kind of thinking and conclusions. But I consider art only one of the process with philosophy, but also humanity and sociology, to exit Plato's scale. You know, or if you want a reference which is more contemporary, to take the blue pill or the red pill in Matrix and to see reality as it is. And the fact that what we think we are living is a lot of illusions. So yes, art is for me, is this. Art is not contemplation, pleasure. Art is efforts. Art is working on oneself. Art is pushing oneself to the limits.
Wow. Also consciousness?
Of course. You know, I'm not the only one. You know, one sentence I love to use is one quote that came from a Christie's interview that I saw of the Boros in Berlin. I'm not quoting them exactly, but the sense is the following. You know, very often when we discover a new artist or new art, we are irritated. We think we don't like it. What makes it different with a contemporary collector is that the contemporary collector will try to understand why he is irritated. And the more he will dive into why he's irritated, the more he will like the work.
A lot of people collect for pleasure, for comfort, as you said. So this is actually something you absolutely not seek.
I never did. And also, That's one of my big problems. You know, you talk about opinionated and controversial very often even. It's because I'm holding very tight to the definition of art.
Mm-hmm.
I consider that a lot of the rest is simply not art. You know, contemporary today doing abstract painting and things like this. I'm sorry, go back to your drawing board and come back with something else. Tell us something we don't know. Surprise us. And that's one of the thing as well, which is going with, you know, people then call me, are you feeling superior, arrogant, and so on, or elitist. I'm not. I just noticed one thing. I believe that to get attracted, I'm not even saying collecting, to be enjoying mm-hmm. contemporary arts, quality contemporary arts, you need to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is okay. A quality that extremely few people have, because everybody wants to live in the same neighborhood, to go to the same restaurant, buy the same clothes, go on holiday to the same place, buy the same cars.
It's a very basic thing.
It's very human as well, because humans, they want to belong. And that's why contemporary art is a very particular thing, which is not accessible to everyone, not because it's elitist, not because it requires some kind of a superior knowledge. Yes, a little bit on the edge. But I'm the proof that it's not the case, because I'm coming from a background with zero collecting, zero art history in my curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just found myself in art because it's opened my mind.
Mm-hmm.
It opened my mind to new dimension, to new kind of people. My benchmark is really going to museums. I realized when I was working in Wall Street that every time I was going to a museum, I was in my 20s and I already started in my 16th. When I was going to a museum, I was feeling serene and I was seeing a lot of things I didn't understand. I remember the first time I went to the Venice Biennale in 1999, I was puzzled, uncomfortable. I said, what the hell? And there are two solutions to this. Either you go back to your comfort zone and you say, bullshit, I hate it. Either you say, maybe there's something and I will dive into it. And I realized that being exposed to some other people's view of the world was greatly improving my vision of the world.
Mm-hmm. In the museums, it's not only contemporary art. And in the museums, there's also a lot of painting and some things we even might call beautiful. You decided to go into contemporary art and also into things yet that were, like in the common definition, not beautiful.
I will be a little bit ironic towards you because I cannot believe really that you believe what you told me. Now, by saying that what you see in the museum is beautiful. Yes, of course, it's beautiful.
Let's say like a Mark Rothko.
Excellent example. You know that Mark Rothko was super extremely pissed off during his entire life because people hated his work. So the thing is, that's exactly where we are. What you consider today beautiful was most of the time considered not beautiful. And that's what interested me, even when going to see museums from all the time, is to try to put myself back at the time. When I look at El Greco, I totally understand why people were shocked. When I see Caravaggio, I understand why people hate it. He's poker players, card players, and so on, because it's got nothing to do with the religious images or the Christ coming from the cross and so on from the time. That's why it took 500 years. When I see the Nymphaeus by Monet, painted in the 1920s, at the time when Cubism was in full strength,
mm-hmm.
I understand why people hated it and why it was rotten and rotting in the studios until the 1950s, was, you know, when American curators rediscovered it and said, it looks like an opening to abstract expressionism.
Do you think it's the same still now? Because now we can much faster perceive things. We find things much faster. Do you think it's the same now that this sort of like challenging contemporary art will be just really valued in a couple of decades?
I have no doubt. The biggest mistake that you can do in finance
mm-hmm.
is to think, oh, this time it will not be like in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest mistake is to say, oh, things have changed. Some things have changed, but a lot of things, you know, if you think that trends turns like this and it will not be a turn, whether anything like even inequality or things like this, you know, it cycles. So Yes. So I'm going to museums. Beauty, to come back to this definition, is very often acquired aesthetic. And that's the worst thing on the planet that you can collect, Daniela. You know it. If today you buy someone that is painting like Picasso, that is reminding you to Basquiat. But again, it's about going outside of your comfort zone.
Mm.
Because everything which is comfort is beautiful. You know, even people find today so amazingly beautiful George Gross. I'm sorry, you know, it's rough and gross and fantastic because it was painted from a guy that was actually in the trenches and was actually seeing his friend being ripped off. And he was seeing death and smelling it all the time. So this is why it was horrible at the time. And it took many, many years that people absorbed this to say, okay, this is amazing. So yes, I have no doubt that today it's the same. I often say that if you're not ready to be uncomfortable, don't waste your money in art. It's that simple. I mean, or maybe collect the old things, which will cost you a lot of money. And it's a little bit then like collecting stamps because you know exactly what is existing and you're trying to find that stamp.
So obviously, although you come from the finance sector, you're not investing in a monetary way into art in that way that it's an investment for resale.
Of course not. I believe that art is the worst place to make investments. Why? Because it is opaque. It is extremely manipulative. It is...
Like some things on the stock market are.
No. Honestly, yes, of course, some. I mean, you have your superb wire card in Germany that you were so keen on it that your Minister of Finance was saying that the Financial Times was lying and he was ready to go to court. And so now it should be ashamed and disappear under the ground. But no, in general, it's not only opaque, but it's also the bid-offer spreads. Daniela, you are a professional, you know, that... At best, what is the best case scenario between the price you are buying and the price you're selling? 50%? Well, no, the best it can be. So it means that any work of art you need to buy needs to increase in price by 50% before you make €1. And 50% is still kind because it's more like 100%. And ask Ribolovlev, you know, it can be making much, much more because the guy can buy it, make 100% commission on it, and still sell it to you. So the opacity, the lack of liquidity, the bid offer spread, the commission that they're taking all over the place makes it one of the worst assets that you can hope to make money out of it. So because of this and because I'm comfortable in the financial market, I said, okay, I'll make money out of the financial market and I will be spending it in art. Also because what I'm interested in is really contemporary art, young art, the art that needs to be preserved today because nobody understands it, nobody values it, and I believe it's important to preserve it for the next generation.
How do you find those artists then?
That's where you came, you started asking your question before asking collecting, who became who you are, and that's what it's interesting is that you realize that it's those fractures that are inside yourself that makes you someone not normal. And we spoke about normality earlier. Normality is the average, the mean. And then there are people on the far end of the distribution. And those people, they feel sometimes awkward in the society as it is, but they feel comfortable among other uncomfortable people.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I can recognize a true collector not by what he's buying, but the way he's behaving.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the major collectors in Germany. I know a few of them, Harald Falkenberg, Ingvild Goetz, Julia Stoschek, and many others, Obrock in Berlin. The more abnormal they are, I mean, my superhero in Germany is Harald Falkenberg. It's simple. The way he discovered and bought the best Poltech at the time when nobody cared, and the way and what he's doing is absolutely amazing. So, and for me, you know, it's one of my mentors, but it's someone that I was looking at from underneath and looking at him upside, saying, wow, this guy really made amazing things. And when he showed his collection for the first time at La Maison Rouge, at a time when it was not common, today it's very common for people to show their collection. Even they show their collection when they don't have enough. They like have a collection for 5 years, which I don't consider a collection at all. But so Ahad was showing his collection there. It was new, very new. And at the opening, I asked him, Ahad, how does it feel to suddenly see your collection in an institution? He answered me this exactly. Alain, what are you asking me as a question? You think I'm thinking about these kind of things? All I'm busy with is living. Okay? That's what it is.
So collecting is living.
Of course. Of course. It's a way of living. And that's why a collector is not a collector just in a gallery. A collector is someone that if he goes to an Ethiopian restaurant, he will not try to find a salmon with a béarnaise. He will ask, what's your specialty? And he will not even try to know what it is. He will just eat it.
Mm-hmm.
A collector is someone that when he's told, oh, the Kochi Biennial is fantastic, will not even ask, where is Kochi? He will say, where's the ticket? This collector will not ask himself, where am I going to put it at home because it's not matching with my sofa? It's too big. It doesn't matter. He will buy it anyway because he considers it important. So, of course, no doubt, art is a way of living.
You said once, I state a quote, you quoted Mira Rubel, art is a language which opens your heart to the other. And that suddenly is a very loving and soft quote also, you know, that's not only like the heart and that challenging, but there seems to be also a softer side to your collecting.
But it's very soft, you know. Take an example. The first works I bought were Nan Goldin.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I cried when I saw The Ballad of Sexual Dependency at the Whitney back in 1996 or something. I cried. I said, wow. Of course, it's different from me. I was working in Wall Street. What do you think I could connect with junkies and transvestites? Okay. I didn't even see at that time. I don't remember even having seen two guys kissing. So for me, homosexuality was even something I was not aware of. You know, my generation was as backwards as this and as conservative as this. So when I saw this, you know, you could say, why? It's because what I saw, and then, of course, I could see from my point of view and say, why? Our pictures are super shocking because mm-hmm. I see fucking transgenders shooting themselves, heroin in the arms. Horrible. I would cross my fingers and I say, oh, this is the devil. Satan is around. Yes, it's true. Let's be honest. I mean, Munich is not that far from you. And Munich is the most conservative part of Germany. So the thing is, what I was seeing there is love.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, what Nan Goldin's photography is pure love, no judgment, okay? Of course, she's very good in the composition of what she's doing, but she's photographing with love, which means that if you try to copy her, you cannot really, because you cannot invent or, you know, you cannot fake love. And that's what it is. So, you know, being different and being disturbed doesn't mean that you need to be doing something very brutal. Of course, you must be able to live with it, to live with strangers, someone that doesn't belong to your category. Or maybe there are a little bit of you. You know, I talked about the collectors and the fracture. You know, maybe some collectors are a minority, even if they are white and male, like Ahad Falkenberg, and coming from a successful business family, because his family was a Mittelstand, very successful in doing those who's of gas stations. He was very proud of that, and he deservedly was. Of course, he was a white male, heterosexual, old, and with a lot of money. But maybe he didn't feel like this. Maybe he felt like he could relate to those people.
Is that the case with you? Is this you also white male heterosexual man?
Of course, of course. And that's what going back, you know, is that in fact, I always have been different. You know, my kids, when I was picking them up at school and when they had girlfriends and they're 12, 13, 14, 15, as you know, at the time, all you want to do is conform, to belong.
Mm.
And I remember they were so ashamed when I was picking them up at school because I was always a little bit doing the clown. And where all they were asking me is, Daddy, can you please for once be normal?
And you as a kid, did you want to belong then, or were you already feeling as an outcast a little bit?
I was. At school, I was. I remember I was a very successful student in a Jesuit school, but I was not feeling comfortable with the religion teaching. I was asking questions about, you know, if God exists, why is there so much suffering? Why is there some people like it was the Dutroux time with the pedophile scandals in Belgium at the time? Why is there pedophilia? Why do we do that to children? Because those two girls, if you remember, died of hunger in terrible suffering. And the answer from the teacher was, this is exactly what it is faith, is that you believe that God sees something and will do something. And that was not enough for me. And I remember that I was maybe 12, 13, and I got a warning that, okay, you are very performing students, very smart and bright, but you need to change your attitude, your critical attitude towards religion. Otherwise, you will go on with your studies in another school. And I felt really very hurt because I felt that they didn't allow me to be different. So, of course, I was not homosexual, or I was not Jew, or I was not Black, or I was not Arab, or I was not a girl. So I didn't have to suffer even more rejection and penalties and prejudices than those other categories of people have. But in my little way, I know what it is to be an outcast. So definitely, and I have no doubt that any of the collectors I mentioned, the good ones, the big ones, the one we recognize, all of them, if you dive into them, they have that kind of neuroses linking them to outcasts. And that's why they feel comfortable with their peers.
Not only true for the collectors, though.
Sure.
And you also said that in an interview, you said that you felt particularly drawn to minorities, as you believe it is in their treatment one can judge the level of maturity of a society. Do you think that feeling came also from knowing how it feels to be an outcast?
Yeah, marginally again, let's not exaggerate my degree of outcasting because I'm still an ultra privilege and it was really marginal. So I don't want to compare myself to the one who suffers. But then you're linking not to the individual experience, because a second hat I'm wearing is also a kind of ethnology sociologist. You know, I've been absolutely fascinated by Claude Lévi-Strauss studies. You know, I'll give you an example. I was fascinated how Claude Lévi-Strauss was explaining incest, because of course incest is probably the worst crime in our societies today. Consider that the most horrible. But where does it find its origin? And in fact, it's going back to the tribes, is that very early on, the tribes that were living somewhere in the forest, in the Amazon or something, among themselves, they realized that if they were having children among themselves, those children were very weak and unhealthy. And they realized that if they were coupling with people from outside of the tribe, they were much healthier. So they decided, in a way, to morally make incest immoral in order to preserve the tribe and to force and to bring slaves from outside and to create alliances with other tribes and so on. So it taught me those elements. So this time I'm observing the world as a whole. And I realized that I was surprised to see that something like 160 countries in the world are declaring themselves democracies because there's someone voting in elections. So I said, that's disturbing. So how do you make a difference between Belgium and Russia or the United States or Egypt or whatever? And then I looked and looked and I realized that really the difference was about minorities. When you win, you crush everyone, like in Iran, and you say, there's only one way, or in Afghanistan right now.
Yes.
Or you try to accommodate the minorities, like Germany does, or Belgium does with gay people or transgender people, allowing to put on their custom files, male, female, or other. It seems a detail, but it's just saying, okay, it's fine. And so that's very, very important for me to understand. And that's where you're really ranking the democracies and the societies and the maturity of them. And I give you another example, which was fascinating to me, is that I had an argument on Twitter, opinionated and so on, because Twitter is my cultural artistic contribution to the world in some way. Even Anne-Sophie Robbins very, very kindly told me a few times that we should do a book about it just as a reflection of a vision of the world, like a work of art in some way.
So you keep all your dialogues on Twitter?
I don't keep them. Maybe someone else will one day, but no, I don't. But they exist. And as you know, they're still there as long as they don't cancel me on it, that will be the case. But I had an argument with Washington Post, very good journalist, because he wrote an article. The title was, "In Belgium, they did it. They're killing children." That was the title. Yes. And what it was an article about minor euthanasia in Belgium. So, yes, it is allowed. I don't think euthanasia is allowed in Germany.
No, it's not allowed.
And again, you see, and that's where, for me, Belgium is a more mature democracy than Germany, because we got rid of that incredible weight of the church that is still weakening a lot of your democratic basis in Germany when they don't exist anymore in Belgium. The church is not existing anymore. And so I was explaining him, but you know, you're totally unfair because there's a very strict process. You need to see three different doctors along a separate time, and so on and so on. And the procedure is very strict. But of course, we don't want people to die in society. But if there is a minority of one, we want to respect this minority of one.
Mm.
Even if it's supposedly questioning the religion and the church and the fact that, no, God decided blah, 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 blah. No, someone is suffering too much of a degenerating disease in terrible pain. Why should I force him to live? And that's the thing.
There are very many questions, and this is why it's very important that there is a super regulated process.
Sure, but let's not get into that debate. But what I mean, you were talking about minorities, but yes, I was saying to that journalist, American journalist, that he should learn more than anyone else to respect minorities in the United States. Because, of course, New York is not Philadelphia or Houston. And there are many, many places where minorities are not respected at all. So that's the difference.
So you think there are different levels of democracies. But I wanted to come back to your collecting, because is it then that the art that you collect that reflects all these questions that you are thinking about, all these themes, these different parts, sociology, policy, all these things?
Yeah, exactly. And I think they are important. I think they're reflecting the society. You were asking me, how do you choose them? You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm adding another dimension, of course, because what I described here was personal. First of all, outcast. Second, ethnology and sociology, as I said. Then a third level is about relevance. And relevance is going through museums, because I go to museums a lot. You know, I would not miss going to the Ludwig or the MoMA or the Prado or the Pompidou or in any time I'm going, or to the National Gallery in London and so on and so on. But I'm not going there from 2021 point of view. I want to understand why this art was kept. And it was kept because it was disturbing at the time. And I need to know history. I think that's another element which is extremely important, is to know history. You know, what was the situation at the time? What was the situation of religion? We are now blaming the Shiite and the Sunni to fighting like disgusting people. And we are very demeaning about them. But let's remember what happened between the Protestant and the Catholics 500 years ago only.
Or not very long ago in Europe, in Ireland.
Yes, exactly. But 500 years ago, the Parisian massacred in the street the Protestant, and it was said that the Seine became red of blood, and it was not an image. So, you know, the massacres they are doing now, of course, it's 500 years later, and we're supposed to have learned, but I'm sorry. We must have a little bit more respect and understanding of why and try to help in other ways.
Also, 500 years are nothing in history.
Exactly. So The other element is about history. You know, when you go to museum, you realize why is this work important. I take an example, the Impressionists. Of course, everybody likes the Impressionists. I don't need to say again why nobody liked the Impressionists when it was created. They had to invent the Salon des Refusés to show their works. Otherwise, they were absolutely refused at the Academy, totally. And I remember an amazing show at Musée d'Orsay where there was the accounting of Durand Ruel, the gallery, the major gallery of the time. What was extremely interesting is that they were showing everything that was sold at the time with the prices of the time. And what was amazing is at the time, there were very beautiful landscape with a sunset and a little boat on a lake. And this was selling like for 20,000 francs or, you know. And behind that, you had a Gauguin, and it was sold for 500 francs or. So at the time, there were tons of the shit that we're receiving in art fairs right now that was selling for a very high price. And people pretend today, oh, if it's Peter Doig is selling for 25 million, it must be good. No, sorry. Explain me why.
Yes, it did change. Absolutely, it did change through the centuries. We have something which we call Salonmaler, painters that only painted for the bourgeoisie, exactly. That were super expensive in their times, exactly. And nobody knows them anymore. Exactly. So there's even a term for that. But coming a little bit back to your personal story, first of all, I think, you know, if you have all these things, all that knowledge, all these different thoughts in your mind, but still you cry in front of an Anne Golden, like the process when you decide to acquire work for your collection because you think it's meaningful and it will stay. Is there a lot of thought involved, or in the end, is it still something very personal and intuitive?
There's a lot of thinking. I consider that, you know, again, one of my mentors was Herman Dalet, who showed this collection for the first time in the House of Kunst in Munich, and then sold this collection of conceptual arts to the MoMA. And he told me, you know, the thing that you must do in contemporary art is to take distance from beauty. It's always an effort. It's all about resisting to advertising. Let's call it like this. You know, we are bombarded by advertising on television. And I'm pretty proud that my kids don't look at advertising, because every single time there's advertising coming on TV, we are changing channel. So we were not looking. And my children were maybe 10 years old, and I loved when one day they said they were looking like a Schwarzkopf advertising with those kind of air, which is shining, blah, blah, blah. And they said to me, they really believe that we're going to believe that you're going to use that shampoo and you're going to have a hair like this? You know? And it's the same in art. The art industry and the art market is a bombardment of temptation and fashion. And the thing is that you must find your own voice. And this is why it's rewarding, is that at the end of it, if you are good because you've got the right fractures, and that's the funny part.
But does that mean you cultivate your fractures?
Of course, of course. You know, the way to live with those fractures is not to be obnoxious to other people, like Kenny Schachter, for example.
Yeah, or not to be in pain all the time.
That's nice to be some pain. I mean, you choose. It's not about pain, because, again, you're just happy to live. What happens to people visiting the collection is that quite a few times they came to me and they said, wow, we love your collection. It's fantastic and so on. But we could never live with it. You see, it's all only about happy to live in discomfort. You know, it goes back to the thing, you know, I'm still flying like if I was in my living room. You know, when I go to an airport and I go to the plane, even now with the COVID, for me, it's exactly the same as sitting in a taxi and or going to the grocery store. It's nothing else. For me, jumping to a plane for 3 days to Mumbai, which would appear to many people like, what the fuck? It's nothing. Okay. So it's just a question of, I don't feel uncomfortable in an airport. I'm not stressed. I know exactly what I need to do. And the same in the train, whether in Austria or in Germany. I was in Berlin not so long ago. You know, I take the train from the new Brandenburg airport to the city center. I just work as if I was in my office. So, you know, that capacity to feel comfortable in uncomfortable situation, it's like a little bit like trading. I'm a trader in bonds. So people say, wow, super stressful. And it's funny because I hired during my career suddenly 100 people in total. And it was very funny because some people were scared to death to make a mistake. And they were so nervous that they were so bad. The real good traders are the ones that are aware that if they are successful in 60% of their trades, they are masters. If they fail in 40, the most important is to cut fast, to admit you made a mistake, turn your back and cut it. The worst is to hang it, to hide it, and to say, no, 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 it's not a mistake, it's not a mistake, it will turn right. No, 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 no. The world, nature, and the economy are always right. So you cannot fight them. So you must adapt. And that's a little bit that mix between my career and the collecting is that both are about adapting. And it keeps me young. I'm 57 today. And yeah, it's about all this. So as you see, we're talking about art, and you know, your listeners will be wondering, when are we talking about the artworks? But we're talking about art.
I find it interesting because it is really very obvious that for you, art and life and work, you know, you don't make a difference. It's not like, oh, this is my leisure time and now I have capacity to think about art. No, it seems to me like one continuous flow of thought and consciousness.
Yeah, and it's not only about visual arts. You know, I'm an absolute desperate fan of movies. And the comparison that I can make with movies is the same. You know, I'm absolutely desperate when I see that the top 10 grossing movies in the world are all sequels of Marvel's or James Bond's or things like this, which for me are simply not movies, they are entertainment. And I say the same about Kusama Infinity Room. People tell me, oh, look, there are 20,000 people ready to pay $20 to stay there 30 seconds. Oh, it must be art. On the other side, a movie which I don't find really excellent, but got the Golden Palm in Cannes, which is The Square. Mm-hmm. You know, I love to look at the figures on Wikipedia. When you see that the total grossing, which means that the total money that was paid to watch this movie in movie theaters is 25 million.
Ooh.
It is only 25 million, despite the fact it's got a Golden Palm, despite the fact that it's got 10,000 lines of review in every single major newspaper and magazine in the world, and people still don't go to see it. It is something which is making me very comfortable when I buy a work and people around me say, are you fucking crazy? You don't see that it's, I don't know, what, there's nothing in there. I know, okay? I know I can also recognize a good movie, a good song, a good artist, a good choreographer.
I mean, it is that what you decide, you just decide.
No, because no. That's no? Something also very important is that the way I describe the collecting is some element of personal, but it's extremely important because I see another weakness. I see sometimes, don't believe that every collector's collecting like me or every outcast is either me or Kenny Schachter. I mean, it's not the same, okay? It's the way you're managing your neuroses. And in the same way as you can say, okay, yes, I'm an outcast and I will collect something, you know, some collectors are collecting themselves, which is something which is leading nowhere. Meaning that when you say, oh, it's about you, no, it's about me thinking my position in the world. And thinking my position in the world is then, you know, my model, another model is Ulrich Sieg in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. I really had an immense admiration for him because he was able to say, wow, I was in China. I realized nobody was collecting this art, which was super important. And so I decided to collect it and to gather it and to preserve it, even, and that's very important, even if I didn't like it. And that's the difference, is that the collectors that are collecting themselves, they only collect the thing they like. And that's why their collection is extremely boring. Because I don't know, I know collectors that are collecting only black and white. Are you joking? I mean, what is this as a category? Okay. Or collectors that are buying skulls or chairs. or whatever. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, it's fun. It's a nice entertainment. It's a nice occupation. Like, I don't know, maybe collecting miniature trains or something like this. But I'm sorry, it's not about art, because what you're trying to do is to preserve a slice of humanity. And it's not about yourself. It's about very quickly you collect something which is larger than you.
So you leave some legacy for the public, for society?
No, I preserve them for now. I have no ambition of building a museum to my genius or whatever else.
No, because in one interview you said that we do not believe that we are more than the custodian of the works of art for the public and for future generations. So there must be some agenda that you really preserve something.
No, I preserve the works. But then when I will be either closer to dying, I will ask my daughters, girls, are you interested in preserving some of that thing, or we get rid of it? And because it's better that I help you, because otherwise it would be a nightmare for you, as you know, because buying is easy, but selling is a nightmare. Art. Coming back to what we said about hazard investments, anybody that wants to be disgusted forever about using art as an investment must try to sell some art. So I would ask them. And if I die crunched by, I don't know, an NFT thrown by Kenny Schachter, then I decide. Either they get rid of it, but I definitely don't want them to build a mausoleum to myself. I believe that some of the works in that collection will be of interest to museums, and maybe we'll buy them at the Rotheum or Philips or Christie's or whoever the dealer will be to take care of it. But for me, as you heard what I said, is that art changed my life. I had a very happy and successful life despite the neurosis and the fractures, but I really enjoyed passionately my life every single day. So the thing is, art is really adding, art bringing me to places I've never been before, meeting people I've never been before. You, for example, we have never met in person, but we met indirectly through Florian, who I met through art, because we were on a panel together in Düsseldorf. And I said, well, this guy can speak for me, in fact. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I've got other guys like this in Yuhi Wihaso in Indonesia. He's a friend. He's not a friend because we met two or three times, but when I'm listening to this guy, he can speak for me. It's funny. He's Indonesian. He's a totally different background, but he believes and he feels the same. So
art can connect people.
Sure. But also, you know, it's those outcasts. And you said, oh, yeah, you know, it's not only the collectors. And you're right. You know, that I liked the art world when it was outcast, meaning artists were outcasts, galleries were outcasts. You know, I love when I'm reading that Werner, the major gallerist, Michael Werner was, you know, of course, he's very rich now with all the works that he preserved in his entire life. But he said, you know, it's a little bit by chance, just because I could not wake up so drunk I was most of the time. And I could not open the gallery, so I didn't sell. It was that time. So now it became an industry, which is something totally different. It's more like a retail industry, more like a luxury retail industry.
Why do you still go to Art Fest then? Because I know that you're visiting Art Fest, although you said in one interview you're not buying on Art Fest. Is that true?
I bought a work at Lista. Art Fair is probably the place where I buy the least, for sure. Why? Because, first of all, you need to understand Art Fair, certainly today, because Art Fair were different. You know, when Zwirner, the old Zwirner, started Cologne, in the 60s, he said, you know, nobody's visiting our gallery, so we should try something. So he put his friends together and they opened Art Cologne. So it was the opportunity to bring a new public. And then it evolved with his own life, art fairs. And it's funny because then galleries who were the founder of all art fairs, whether it's Basel, Brussels, yeah, Armory, and so on, released the management of it and gave it to big companies. And then big companies managed it in a totally different way and made it an event, which was, in a way, escaping the control of the galleries. So they became shopping malls. And that's where it became much more interesting in terms of arts. But they're still a very important now outlets, because I call them outlets. And as a gallerist, it's important to have different outlets. You've got your gallery, you've got art fairs, You've got pop-ups, you've got the museums and the biennials, which are more and more becoming extensions of the galleries. But you need art fairs for the clients, that is clients of three types. First, the one that doesn't have the time, even if nothing is better than visiting the galleries or the museums, but sometimes you don't have the time for whatever, your career, your young family or something like this. The one that are social, that happy to buy art, but only if other people see them buying art.
It's like collector and art world 101, but sorry to interrupt you.
No, but art fair is this, either lack of time, either wanting to be shown buying art, either needing to have friends and bring friends and saying, what do you think of this? Oh, I like it. Oh, and you, what do you think of this? And then when five people say it's good, then they buy it. When I am the contrary, when five people tell me they like it, I start being mistrusting. I say, ooh, this is no good. If people like it, it's no good. You know, I remember when I saw Nicolas Party. They were jumping on each other in a special booth of Gabby Hufkens at Brussels a few years ago. And I said, come on. Ridiculous. But that's the same people that are fighting for the same cars, the same jackets, the same bags, the same Birkin bag, the same wife. In fact, same type, blonde, big titties, big mouth, and so on. You know, that's the kind of people that go to fairs. And they are important because they're giving money. And I say to galleries, take the money, guys, and do good shows in the galleries.
And they enable us to make some really hardcore shows, which probably are not commercial at all, but some money has to pay for it.
Exactly. So that's why I'm not against art fair. I'm not there to say they should not exist. And I go to art fair for another reason, is that I would say that 70% of the reason is networking.
Mm.
For better or worse, art is networking. It's about listening to people, meeting people you have not met for a long time. I was happy in Basel to meet my American friend, my Colombian friends, my Asian friends, the galleries that I haven't seen for a long time. And it's about talking, you know, what's going on? How is it on your side? You know, how did you go through this? And so on and so on. So it's all about networking. It's still humans. And that's why I don't want to give up. I'm collecting digital art, but I don't want to go full metaverse, NFT shit thing and so on, because I still believe it's a human activity and we need each other. And definitely something I learned from COVID is that, you know, again, there's an American gallerist sending me a huge Google Drive thing and said, what do you think of this artist? And I said, I'm so sorry. I cannot express an opinion if I don't see it in real. I cannot decide on based on a PDF, except for an artist I already know. But in no circumstances I am this kind of thing. So maybe I'm too old, or I consider culture as a physical activity. You know, seeing a choreography or a ballet or a piece of theater, you know, it's not the same if you are in the room or if you sit on TV. And a piece of art is the same thing. So I decided that art was something. And the good thing is that I am, contrary to what many people think, quite antisocial, which means that I could stay home for, you know, for me, COVID was a fantastic time. I had to see no one. And I didn't have to find excuses. So it was wonderful. Except that it's going too far, then I'm becoming a hermit. And a hermit is something very bad. So, you know, art is forcing me to go out of my cave. So I'm happy to go, but I'm so happy to go back to my cave afterwards. You know, since I'm at Basel, my beard grew and my hair grew and so on. And I didn't see any humans, didn't go any dinners, didn't go to any opening. And it will be the same until freeze. And I think many of my fellow collectors, I mean, try to meet Julia Stoschek. She's always hiding in her upper floor most of the time and appearing like a fairy tale for a few seconds, and then she goes back to her friends and so on.
Alain, I think we could talk for hours.
So this is part one.
This is part one. Let's make it part one. I think there's so much more to say and to think about and to learn, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
Good.
But I want to ask you for this time a last question, like a little bit. You just were starting with the last year and COVID and all of that, and also the physical necessity of humans to be together and to be in real spaces and to discover and encounter real art. So what are your prospects like for the near future? Do you think something will change? Will we be more human? Will we be nicer to each other? Will something come out of that or not?
No. I'm pessimistic. Again, this has got little to do with art, because I said over and over and over again, art means nothing if it's not related to larger society. The people that are looking at the art world without considering it as a microcosm of a larger society, implying inequalities, gender racism, well, racism in general, and class war. Class war is extremely important in the art world, and people kind of neglect because they think we're all friends. I mean, I see so many collectors saying, I'm friends with artists. I'm sorry, man, you're not. You're not, because you are extremely rich and they are extremely poor. So still, when are people from this kind of things are friends? They're not.
But they move in the same space.
They move in the same space and pretend to be friends because they need each other. So what I mean is that looking around me, looking at the situation in Europe with Hungary, Poland, Turkey, with the United States, where we're going forward to a terrible constitutional crisis, if ever, Trump is the candidate for the Republicans in 2024, which is only 2-3 years ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And I'm also pessimistic in the way that I'm looking at history. You know, if we look at the fall of the Berlin Wall, about the civil rights movement in the 1960s, in feminism in the 1970s and 60s, or the suffragette in the 1930s or 40s, I don't remember exactly. Sorry for the mistakes if I made one. You know, it was liberation fights. And we reached that liberation in the 1970s. And you're aware of that, you're the same age as me. So what I'm seeing is more and more conservative. When I see, for example, that's the result of the German elections, when the two parties where the young people were voting the most, mm-hmm. which one were they?
The Green and the Liberals.
Exactly. So it's very interesting. Why would young people vote for Liberal? Because from my time, people said, is that if you are not a socialist in your 20s, is because you have no heart. And if you are still a socialist in your 50s, you've got no brain. What I mean is that I find my kids getting more conservative than me.
But don't you think it's the wave between the generations, that there was a more radical generation, like the punk generation, or before that, the hippie generation?
No, the punks were another movement. They were a reaction to the materialism of the 1980s. And they were just a little blink. They were not a movement.
No, they were not a movement. That's true, but the hippies were a movement.
In some way, but they were absorbed as well. So, I mean, it's not about materialism. It's also the relationship to the bodies. You know, we are from a generation where we are quite well in our bodies. We, you know, if you go still in Ibiza, the only guys still naked, unfortunately, are the ugly 50s and 60s. Okay? 60 years old.
Yeah, we feel more comfortable, we feel more free. That's true. There is a generation which is very, very, very concerned and very anxious with their bodies.
Yeah, and it's funny, but even my girls are pretty good looking, but I mean, sorry, swim bathing topless is nonsense. And of course, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny little detail, but it's the same about openness towards other races, immigrants, or things like this. It's not that easy. And I'm a little bit pessimistic about the future because the problems that were before COVID are only reinforcing themselves, inequality, racism, sectarism in many ways. And unfortunately, post-truth, and I know it because I'm in serious arguments, right now, the well-educated people, when someone is shouting, they're hiding. And when I see someone shouting, I go to him and I say, why are you shouting? You want me to shout louder than you? I'm just a centrist, but I'm a loud centrist. Because the problem is we don't hear the centrist anymore. You know, they're shutting up. Because we hear only the extreme right or the extreme left. But I'm extreme centrist. And I say, fuck you. With your way of seeing the reality, it's a nightmare. So now you speak to each other, I fucking bomb you. Okay? It's simple. I can use violence as well. I can bomb the extreme. You know, why are we bombing only the guys in the middle? Why is it only the Rote Achse-Fraktion or the AfD who is bombing? You know, why are we not bombing from the middle?
Yeah, because we try to be more civilized, not to kill others.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, nature is not civilized. Nature includes death all the time, includes renewal of the weakest and so on. It's natural. So, okay, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I'm
a little bit.
You know, I want to keep my stance of that central grounds, because that's the only way to move forward in some way. And we have extremes in anything, even in arts. We have massive extreme. We have the people that believe only in the markets, and we have people that are believing only in NFT as a kind of the populism, and it's nothing else than populism. It's pure populism. It's the same as QAnon, the same as anti-vax, the same as they stole the elections. It's the same. You know, I love digital art, but NFT is not digital art. And the same at the other side, that there are people are saying, oh, you're really stupid and dumb not to buy paintings. But I know why I'm not buying painting. I'm not buying painting because the wealthy, they're only considering art as being painting. And they're considering that it's the only kind of speculative instrument that they can find in art. So they buy painting. And that's exactly what I don't want art to be. So I don't collect painting. So it's got nothing with the fact that I don't believe there are good painters. But I believe that if you want to express the reality of today, you must preserve the art that is non-painting. Sorry, this is already supposedly for part 2 or 3 or 5.
Yes, but you know, the good thing is, it's very rare, that's true, that somebody like as centrist and but also as acclaimed in the art world is so outspoken as you. And the good thing is there are so many other opinions and people have the rights to just do, you know, if they just want to buy their paintings, that's their full right. So that's also okay.
I'm not acclaimed. There are more people hating me in the art world than loving me. Enough people loving me to make me keep going in that thing. That's it.
Alain, thank you so much for now.
Thank you.
And talk again, definitely.
I'm there. You have my phone number.
For more information on Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast, follow us on Instagram at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. Visit our website, van-horn.net, and subscribe to Voices on Art on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.